appointment. She'd already had to tell Eli to speak to him after Dexter had asked her if Ari was a doctor, and when Sarah had said, "No, what made you think that?" Dexter had reported that Ari had told him he'd had a late-night appointment with a lady who'd needed her vitamin D. "I just hope you're being safe," she said, hating the scolding schoolmarm's way she sounded. He gave her a lazy grin and ran one hand through his disheveled hair. "We kept our masks on." Shaking her head, Sarah walked past him, adding Ari's intrusion to the list of things she'd make Eli answer for. She washed her hands in the kitchen and started up the stairs. She'd meant to walk but found herself stomping as she approached the bedroom, with her pulse hammering in her throat. "I'm going to say something," she thought. "I'm going to tell him that if things don't change, he'll have to leave. I can't keep going like this." She opened the bedroom door. Eli was in the closet, standing in front of his tie rack, in suit pants and an undershirt. His feet were bare, shoulders were slumped, his posture defeated. And on his face was a look of such aching despair that Sarah's first impulse was to go to him, wrap her arms around him, to hold him and tell him that whatever was wrong would be okay, that they'd figure it out together. At the sound of her footsteps, Eli turned. She could see him gathering himself, smoothing his face into a semblance of calm. But she'd already seen how miserable he'd looked. Was he sick? Could that be it? "Eli," she said. He gave her a rueful look, then turned his face to the floor. In a low voice, he said, "I know." She stared at him, stunned into silence. "What?" she asked. "You know what?" "I know Ari's downstairs on the couch." He took a breath. "I know I've been a terrible husband. I know I've been ignoring you. I know." His voice cracked. Sarah felt the surprise of that admission hitting her body like pellets of hail. She felt again that yearning to cross the room, to take him in her arms and comfort him. But before she could start moving, Eli turned back toward the ties. "Why?" she asked, her voice sharp. "Why have you been ignoring me? What's going on?" She crossed the room and put her hand on his shoulder, feeling him stiffen under her touch. "Can't you tell me?" His shoulders rose as he inhaled. "Not now." Sarah felt her face get hot. "Why not?" "I can't," he said in a leaden voice. She slipped her arm around his waist and leaned against him, inhaling his familiar scent, his comforting warmth. She squeezed him. Eli did not put his arm over her shoulders and squeeze back. "Just wait until the wedding's over," he said. "We can talk about everything then." "Are you having an affair?" His eyes widened in shock. "No," he said, sounding startled that she'd even think it. And his denial sounded heartfelt. But there was something going on. His posture, his expression, all of it looked guilty. "No?" she asked. He shook his head mutely. "So what is it then? I don't understand. Why can't you tell me what's wrong?" she asked. She could hear herself sounding loud and raw and pained. "I can't," he said in a strange, muted voice. "I'm sorry, Sarah, but I just can't." "Eli," she tried to sound reasonable, "you're my husband. We're a team. You can't just check out of this marriage and not even tell me why." Eli didn't respond. She waited, giving him a chance, staring at him, mentally begging him to say something. When it was clear he'd said all that he meant to, she let go of his waist and stepped back. "Eli, I got an apartment," she said in a rush. She saw the words, not him, saw his body sag. "It's just a studio, near the school. I rented a piano. I need... She waved her hands, angry to the point of speechlessness. "I know." His voice was a hollow echo of itself. He looked and sounded like a pale, thin facsimile of her husband, his voice holding none of the familiar warmth, his expression showing no concern. "Fight for me," Sarah thought. "Fight for us. Tell me I can't go. Tell me you'll do better. Tell me what's wrong." Instead, what Eli said was, "I understand." "Well, I don't," Sarah snapped. Instead of an answer, all she got was another sigh. "Do what you have to do." He selected a tie and left the closet, gathering his shirt and his suit jacket and his wallet. Then he slipped his feet into his goddamn fucking flip-flops and went slap-slapping out of the room without a backward glance, leaving Sarah alone, furious and bewildered, her thoughts right back to where they'd been that morning. "He's having an affair." That thought was followed almost immediately by more despairing ruminations. "But I love him, and how can he do this? And oh God, what am I going to do now?" Eli. It happened on a Friday night in 1999, when Annette was pregnant and miserable, right after they'd moved back to New York. They'd had a horrible fight. Annette had accused him of sabotaging her birth control pills in an attempt to force her to have a baby that he knew she never wanted, to live a life she would hate. Eli had looked at her as she'd yelled at him, wondering where the shrieking harpy with matted hair and dark circles under her eyes had come from, and what she'd done with his competent, curious, up-for-anything wife. "I'm leaving," Annette had screamed. She'd thrown handfuls of clothes into a duffel bag, ignoring Eli's attempts to comfort her. "I'm going to my sister's. Don't call me," she'd said, and slammed the door behind her. Eli had gone to a bar, with nothing more in mind than having a few beers, watching a ball game, trying to calm down and come up with a plan, even though he was starting to realize he was in an unwinnable situation. All he could do was hope that Annette would look at her baby and fall instantly in love, and just as instantly into happily contented motherhood. And that was feeling increasingly unlikely. Eli had been on his second lager when he'd seen the woman, standing in a corner, in a black leather jacket and a top so tight he could make out the edge of her lacy bra beneath it. She was gorgeous, lushly curvy, with dark hair falling in waves down her back and dark red lipstick on her mouth. Eli could see her in profile, lit by the glow of the jukebox, and he'd stared at her, helplessly enthralled. Eventually, the woman turned, as if she'd felt his gaze like a weight on her hair and her body. She'd spun slowly and had given him a saucy smile. Then she came sauntering toward him, hips swinging until she was close enough that he could smell her perfume, musky and sweet. Annette never wore perfume or lipstick. Eli could barely breathe. He loved Annette. He had promised to spend his life with Annette. Annette was having his baby, but oh God, this woman. He wanted to devour her, to rip off her clothes and throw her down on the bar. She looked at him, and he saw in her eyes that she knew everything he was feeling. She'd touched his arm, then his knee. "Hi," she'd said, and had run her tongue slowly across her glossy red lips, flashing her white teeth in a smile. 5 minutes later, they'd been wrapped around each other in a dark corner by the restrooms. When the woman had slipped her tongue into his mouth, sucking at his lower lip, then biting it lightly, Eli felt like he'd been swept away by a wave of warm honey, slow-moving and sweet and irresistible. He cupped the woman's chin and touched her face. Her skin was so soft and the smell of her perfume was all around him, and he stopped thinking about his wife or the baby on the way. "Maybe she's a prostitute," his mind said, but his thoughts felt foggy and dim. his sensible instincts very far away. Somehow he'd paid their tabs and gotten the woman out of the bar, down the block into the lobby of his apartment building. As soon as they were in the elevator, they'd fallen on each other like desperate, starving animals. Eli backed her into a corner and pressed her mouth against his, kissing and kissing her, like her mouth held the last bit of oxygen on Earth. He breathed her in and her mouth held his last breath. He licked at her, tasting her lipstick, and oh God, he could feel her body, her breasts pressing against his chest, the soft pressure of her belly and thighs against him. He thought he would die if he couldn't get inside her. He pulled his mouth free long enough to suck in a breath as the woman gasped, "Don't stop," and wrapped one hand behind his neck, pulling his mouth back down to hers. When they finally got to his apartment, he'd yanked off her jacket and ripped, literally ripped, the woman's shirt off her body, a thing he'd never done before. Buttons clattered on the floor. Her breasts were warm in his hands, her nipples already hard, as firm and sweet as berries. She tugged his pants open and Eli pushed her back against a wall, and she was wrapping her legs around him, gasping, almost sobbing, one word over and over, "Yes, yes, yes," she panted into his open mouth. When he'd tried to pull away, realizing that he didn't have condoms, she pulled him right back to her. "Don't worry, I'm safe." That was when he'd had the briefest instant of clarity, a few seconds when it seemed like he was outside of his own body, looking down at himself, his briefs around his knees and some woman who was not his wife in his arms. "Wait," he'd tried to say, but the woman had taken his hand and pressed his fingers between her legs, against that slick, welcoming channel, and Eli had been lost. He'd gripped her shoulders and slid inside her in one delirious push, surrounding himself in her warmth, thrusting hard and fast like the world was ending, like this was the last thing he'd ever get to do. Afterward, they ended up on the floor, Eli flat on his back and gasping, the woman curled against his side. "So what's your name?" she asked in a lazy, amused voice. Eli was hit with a wave of such paralyzing guilt, such awful, utter, all-consuming blackness, that he'd been, for a moment, unable to breathe. He'd felt his chest spasm, and he'd managed to force out a single moan. "What?" asked the woman, rolling toward him, her dark hair hung over her shoulder. "What is it?" Eli couldn't speak. He managed to shake his head, a negating side to side. "No, what?" asked the woman. A hint of a smile curved her full lips. "No, you don't have a name, or no, you don't want to tell me?" "I've never done anything like this before. I'm married," Eli croaked. "I have a wife. She's not here," said the woman, before he could say pregnant. "And as far as I'm concerned, it's her fault for letting someone as handsome as you walk around on his own." Handsome. Unbelievably, Eli felt himself stirring again as the woman slid her hand across his chest, then down, down, down. "I can't," he muttered. "You already did," the woman pointed out. She removed her hand. "Don't," Eli kept himself from gasping. "Don't stop." She got to her feet and stretched, with her arms extended over her head, standing on the tips of her toes, her back arched, thrusting her breasts up. From the floor, he could see every inch of her, her toenails painted dark red, the juicy, rounded curves of her calves and thighs and belly, the soft, black, curling hair between her legs, her breasts tipped with sweet, dark red nipples, and, oh God, she had hair under her arms, gorgeous, curling thickets of hair. Eli felt his mouth fill with saliva as he got to his feet. He reached out and touched her there, stroking with a single fingertip. She was so soft. He bet she smelled delicious. He wanted to bury his face there, to sniff, to lick, to kiss, to bite. She looked up at him from underneath her long, curling lashes. "You got a bed in this place?" He managed a nod. She arched an eyebrow. "Think you could show me?" He nodded again, then bent and scooped her, every warm, soft, sweet, fragrant, delectable, irresistible inch of her into his arms. And if the first time had been incredible, the second time was a revelation. The hair under her arms and between her legs was just as soft as Eli knew it would be, and its smell was the smell of sex itself, dirty and sweaty and intoxicating. Even better was the way this woman talked, murmuring the hottest, filthiest, most explicit commands in Eli's ear, telling him what she was going to do to him, asking him to do things, telling him how all of it felt. "Lick your finger. Now slide it inside of me, slow. Oh, like that, just like that." Her eyes had glinted with a devilish light as she'd grabbed his wrist, pulled his hand toward her mouth, and slipped his slick finger between her lips, sucking her own juices off Eli's skin. "Deeper," she said, "harder, more." Eli thought his head was going to explode. They'd had sex. No, Eli thought savagely, they'd fucked 3 times that night. The last time he'd taken her from behind, on her hands and knees, with the warm weight of her ass smacking loudly against his thighs as he thrust and thrust. "I feel like an animal," he managed to gasp. The woman turned her head, looking at him over her shoulder. Her white teeth glinted as she smiled. "Baby, we're all animals," she'd said. Then she'd pushed herself upright, up on her knees, with Eli still inside her. "Yeah, like that, faster, 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 faster. I want to come while you're inside me." After the 3rd time, they'd fallen onto the sex-stiffened sheets, and both of them had slept. When he'd opened his eyes again, it was after 8 o'clock. The apartment filled with early morning light. Eli stared at the clock. In that first moment of awareness, he hadn't remembered what he'd done, and his first conscious thought was to wonder why his thighs felt so sore. Then he looked down and saw the woman, still asleep, hair tumbled over Annette's pillow. Guilt crashed over him like a collapsing building. He must have made some kind of noise loud enough to wake the woman, who yawned and stretched and slowly opened her eyes. "Good morning, handsome," she said. Then she dropped her eyes from his face to his chest to his morning erection. "Mmm," she hummed. The sheet had slipped down to show the curve of her breast. When she saw where he was looking, she'd brought her hand down, cupping her own breast, pinching her nipple, making it hard. She slipped her other hand under the covers, gliding it along his thigh until she found his erection and squeezed. "Looks like somebody's glad to see me." "No," he said and sat up straight. "No, you have to go." She'd looked at him curiously for a moment. Then those lush lips had frowned, and her pretty face settled itself into a mask of indifference. She'd swept out of the bed, curvy bottom flashing, bending down to snatch her clothes off the floor, and sashay into the bathroom, slamming the door behind her. Eli got dressed and collected $200, all the cash he had. He'd never paid for sex and had no idea how these transactions were conducted. When the woman emerged, he said, "We never discussed." Wordlessly, he thrust the money at her. She looked at it, then at him, indifference replaced by hurt. "I'm not a prostitute," she snapped. "I'm sorry," he blurted, feeling embarrassment in addition to shame. "A gift, then." He held the folded stack of bills. She looked at him again, then snatched them, slipping them into her pocket, and walked out the door with her head held high. Eli had gone to the bathroom where he stood under scalding hot water until there was no hot water left. Then he stood under the cold water until he was shivering and his lips were blue. He forced himself to endure it, resting his head against the tiles as the icy water beat down. His own father had cheated on his mother endlessly, almost compulsively. Eli had sworn to himself that he'd be different, a different kind of man, a different kind of husband. And yet there he'd been, not even 3 months after his own wedding, buried between a strange woman's legs. He was so disgusted with himself he wanted to vomit, or scrub until his skin came off. Never again, he told himself. Annette can never find out, and I'll never do this again. He'd called Annette's sister's number 3 times that day. No one picked up. And then, that night, somehow he found himself back at the bar. The woman was waiting for him, as if they'd made plans to meet, standing by the jukebox with hair cascading down her back in those glorious waves, that sweet dark red lipstick on her lips. As he walked toward her, she gave him a wink and a slow, knowing smile. She wore a dress that night, a tube of jersey fabric that clung to every inch of her, riding the curves of hip and waist and bosom. No buttons, she'd explained, as they grabbed at each other in the elevator. I can't have you wrecking every piece of clothing that I own. 5 minutes after they'd walked through the door, the woman was lying back on the bed, and Eli was kneeling on the floor with her legs resting on his shoulders and his face between her legs. She tasted like honey and salt, Eli thought as he licked her, like candied apples and the sea. What's your name? He asked, after she'd thrashed and keened her way through her first 2 orgasms. She'd opened her eyes, and he'd watched the calculations that were surely taking place behind them. Jane, she'd said very softly. Call me Jane. It was clearly an alias. Maybe she, too, had something to hide, a boyfriend or a husband at home. Eli waited for her to ask his name again, or even to make a joke about how he could be Tarzan. But instead, she'd worked herself down the bed, down his body, and then her mouth was full, and he wouldn't have been able to answer her even if he'd wanted to. For the next 2 nights, they were together. They did not exchange histories or confidences. They didn't talk about their pasts or their futures. He didn't know where she lived or how old she was, or what she did for a living, and she didn't ask him a single thing about himself. It was nothing but chemistry, the alchemy of bodies coming together in a seemingly unstoppable way. On the third morning, the last morning, he'd propped himself up on his elbow and looked down at her. Her skin was lit gold by the morning sun. Her full lips were parted, each exhalation stirring the fine hairs on her forearm as she breathed. She was gorgeous, Eli thought, the most beautiful woman he'd ever touched. She opened her eyes and gave him that now familiar smile. But for once, for the first time, Eli didn't feel an answering surge from his traitorous body. The fever had broken. The infection was over. His voice was steady when he spoke. I can't see you again. I'm sorry. Jane had stretched, one long, languorous shudder working its way from her curled toes to her fingertips. She had gotten out of bed, gathered her things, and walked toward his door, hips swaying their clockwork sway. At the door, she turned and winked at him, a see you tonight kind of wink. But Eli had finally found his strength. He hadn't gone back to the bar that night. Instead, he'd taken the sheets and pillowcases to the laundry and washed them in hot water and cleaned the apartment, scrupulously wiping down every surface the woman had touched. The next day, after class, he'd gone out and gotten dozens of yellow tulips, Annette's favorite. Then he'd driven to Annette's sister's house, handed his wife the flowers, told her that he loved her and brought her home. "How are you?" he'd asked as she clambered into the car. Instead of answering, she'd just given an unhappy shrug. 2 weeks later, Eli walked outside on his way to the subway and to his morning's first class. Jane had been sitting on the park bench across the street, wearing her leather jacket and a sad look on her face. Eli's heart dropped. A part of him wanted to run. Instead, he made himself walk toward her, schooling his face into stillness. Her dark hair was gathered in a limp ponytail. Her nails and her lips were unpainted, and there were dark smudges under her eyes. "What's going on?" Eli asked, his voice brusque, almost rude. She looked up at him steadily. He felt his heart sink even further. "I'm pregnant." Of course, he thought. All the times they'd had sex, for 3 nights in pretty much every position on basically every available surface of the apartment, including the bathroom counter and the breakfast bar. There'd only been that first brief conversation about birth control. "Don't worry, I'm safe," the woman had said, and Eli had believed her. The bagel he'd eaten that morning in his sunny kitchen, waiting for the water to boil so he could bring his wife the tea she hated but had to drink instead of coffee, felt like it was going to erupt out of his mouth. Had he really thought he'd get away with this? Had he actually imagined there would be no consequences for cheating, for having incredible illicit sex with another woman while his wife was unhappy and suffering? The woman's voice was hard-edged when she spoke. "And don't even ask if it's yours, because I haven't been with anyone else." Eli hadn't planned on asking. He pinched the bridge of his nose with his thumb and forefinger, scrubbed one hand through his hair, and forced himself to breathe as he imagined Annette finding out, and leaving, and taking the baby with her, leaving him stuck raising a child with this woman about whom he knew nothing, not even her last name. "I'm not going to keep it," the woman said coolly. Eli felt the breath whoosh out of him. The woman's mouth had a bitter twist. "So don't worry, you don't have to look like your whole life just went down the shitter." He nodded. "How much is?"
$600,
she said. Eli swallowed hard, part of him wondering if she was scamming him, if this was what she did, sleep with strange men for entire weekends and then show up telling them that she was pregnant. But another part saw those dark shadows beneath her eyes, saw the ragged, chewed thumbnail on her right hand, and believed her, and knew that $600 was a small price to pay. "Wait here." He'd jogged into the lobby and taken the elevator up to the apartment, calling some excuse in the direction of the bedroom where Annette was still in bed. In the kitchen, he'd rifled through the mail until he'd found the check his grandparents had sent him and Annette for their wedding, and another from an aunt in Arizona. The woman had walked with him to the bank branch, waiting on the sidewalk while he went inside. "Hundreds okay?" asked the teller, and Eli had nodded, watching as she'd slipped the crisp bills into a white envelope. He and Annette had talked about buying a new couch with some of the wedding money, hoping to replace the sagging, cat-clawed IKEA sofa that the previous tenant had left behind. Maybe she wouldn't remember, Eli thought. Back outside, he handed the woman the envelope. She folded it in half and slipped it into her purse. "Do you want me to come with you?" he asked. "When you have it done?" She'd looked startled. Then she looked sad. "No." Her voice was glum, her posture defeated. "I'll take care of it at home, back in California." She made a sad, scoffing noise and tugged at the end of her ponytail as she shook her head. "New York hasn't been so good to me." Eli felt another stab of guilt. It wasn't the city, it was him. Him, and probably other men who'd treated her like she was disposable, an object for their pleasure. "I'm sorry. Really, I am." He'd pulled one of his business cards out of his pocket, he'd just gotten them, for when he'd start seeing patients at the school's clinic. Then the pen he'd taken from the bank. He wrote his home number on the back of the card. "Here," he told the woman. He'd handed it over and watched as she'd read it. "That's me, Eli Danhauser. That's my number if you need to reach me." He'd tried to smile. "Or if you need your teeth cleaned." "Thank you." She put the card in her purse, gave him a wavering smile, and touched his hand. "You're a good guy."
"I'm not," he thought. "I definitely am not."
She'd turned, walking away, the ruffled red skirt of her dress swishing against her thighs. Eli watched her go, feeling almost faint again as he thought, "I got away with it. I think I actually got away with it." And after that, Eli had been good. He'd kept to his promise, never to stray again. As the summer went on, he'd go hours without thinking of Jane, or whatever her real name was. Then hours became days, days became weeks, then months of not thinking of what he'd done. And then, on the subway, he'd see a flash of long, wavy hair, or he'd see a woman in a red dress with a leather jacket on the sidewalk, or, standing in line at the coffee shop, he'd catch a whiff of a familiar perfume, floral and musk, and the memories would come slamming back into his body, leaving him feeling battered and breathless. Maybe he'd been possessed, he'd think, shaking his head, or maybe it had just been something he'd needed to get out of his system, a poison he'd had to expel before he could settle into being a good husband, a good father, a good man. Annette had left when Ruby was just 6 months old. Eli had been a single father, and then he'd met Sarah, and had fallen in love, and they'd become a family of three, then four, then five. He'd blinked and had become somehow middle-aged, with silver hairs in his beard and a bald spot he couldn't see but still knew was there. He'd lived decades of his life believing he'd gotten away with those few nights of madness. He'd been thoughtlessly happy, with no sense of a sword hanging over his head. Then the pandemic had arrived, and Ruby had come home, and she'd brought Gabe. Eli would never forget the afternoon he'd met his daughter's intended. He'd been coming down the stairs to make himself a snack, and he'd walked into the kitchen and seen a dark, sleek head leaning against his daughter's curls. The young man had looked up, and he'd had exactly the same slant to his eyebrows that Eli remembered, precisely the same tilt to the corners of his lips, and the same wide, dark eyes. For a moment, it was like time had spun itself backward, and he was 29 again, gangly and clueless, a married man but still mostly a boy. Eli stood, paralyzed, in front of the refrigerator. He could barely move, could barely breathe. "Daddy, this is Gabe," Ruby had said. "He's going to be staying with us for a while." The boy had walked over to him, hand extended. Even his fingernails were the same shape as the nails of that long-ago woman, a dozen tiny, ineffable things that all added up to a single, inescapable conclusion. The mug that Eli had grabbed, one with the words, "World's Best Dad," hand-painted on its side, fell out of his hands to shatter on the terracotta floor. Ruby had made that mug for him years ago. Sarah had taken her to one of the paint-your-own pottery shops that had been popular back then to help her make a Father's Day gift for Eli. Hashtag irony, Eli thought dimly. "Oops," he said, his voice too loud. "Oh, no," Ruby had cried and bent down to gather the shards. Gabe had given Eli a friendly smile. Eli made himself shake the boy's hand. "So, Gabe, where are you from?" "Los Angeles," he said. "I'll take care of it at home, back in California." Eli kept himself motionless, remembering that Jane, or whatever her name really was, had been set on having an abortion. He couldn't be sure, even if, through some terrible coincidence or joke of fate,
this boy really was her son, that didn't necessarily mean that Eli was his father.
And how are you finding New York City?
I love it here. The boy gave his daughter a fond look. It hasn't broken my heart yet, Ruby says.
Ruby took Gabe's hand and came to stand beside him so that they were hip to hip and thigh to thigh. Eli swallowed hard.
Gabe did the Buckeye with me last fall, and he sings in an indie rock band.
Eli nodded. Eli smiled. He felt like a wind-up toy going through the motions he had to make, behaving the way he knew he had to behave.
So are you a senior, like Ruby?
Yep, not at Tisch, though. I'm in CAS, the College of Arts and Sciences.
So you're 21?
Yep.
He gave Ruby a squeeze. Ruby's 5 months older than I am. My old lady, he said, and kissed Ruby's forehead, right above her glasses.
Eli cast his mind backward, scrolling through the calendar, adding 9 months to the date of his hookup, trying to remember precisely how pregnant Annette had been when she'd gone storming off to her sister's.
And you're a native Californian? He asked Gabe.
Yep, born and raised.
Any brothers or sisters? What do your parents do?
Daddy, said Ruby, can we skip the third degree, or at least save it till dinner time?
It's fine, said Gabe, with an easy smile. An easy, familiar smile.
No brothers or sisters. It's always just me and my mom.
And what does she do?
Dad!
Ruby's tone had sharpened.
She likes to sing, Gabe said, but she's a nurse.
Singing and nursing meant nothing to Eli, who could remember exactly how Jane had tasted, how she'd smelled, the filthy things she'd whispered in his ear while they were in bed, the tiny cooing noises she'd made, but hadn't bothered to ask about her job or her hobbies. He made conversation with his daughter and this boy, all the while with that numbness spreading through his body, up to his hairline and out to his fingertips. As soon as he could escape, he'd gone to his office, opened his laptop, and started searching for Gabe. Gabe's account was private, but later that night, he approved Eli's friend request. Eli scrolled through hundreds of pictures, Gabe at college, Gabe at home, Gabe at parties, on beaches, on stage, until he finally located a picture of Gabe with a woman he presumed was Gabe's mother. It was a shot from a high school graduation ceremony. Gabe, in cap and gown, had his arm around the woman Eli was almost positive was the one he remembered from long ago. Almost, but not completely positive. Her hair was shorter, her face looked older, but was it still essentially the same face? A big part of him said yes. A small, increasingly desperate-sounding part said no. Another part of him still clung to the hope that even if his mother was Jane, Gabe probably had a different father. And the biggest part, shrill and terrified, was saying that he had to find out if Gabe and Ruby were using reliable birth control, because Ruby getting pregnant would be a nightmare. But Ruby getting pregnant with a boy who turned out to be her half-brother would be a tragedy beyond all imagination. Another part, a cool, mocking part, had questions. Like, had Eli really imagined he'd gotten away with it? Had he actually thought his sin would go unpunished? Well, the joke was on him. He thought of something that he'd once heard Ruby say. Karma might not always be fast, but that bitch is always on time. And now she'd sprung her trap. Eli would be forced not only to confess to his long-ago transgression, but also to break his daughter's heart. He could imagine the look on her face, her eyes wounded behind her glasses. You cheated on my mom? And Sarah. What would Sarah think of him when she found out? I think we need some time apart, he could imagine her saying, her voice cool. She'd turn away from him, leaning forward so that her hair would obscure her face. I think you should move out for a while. He'd lose his daughter, his wife, his home, everything. Eli plodded through the rest of the year numb and shamed and frozen. Part of him, most of him, argued persuasively that Gabe couldn't be his. Gabe's mother's name was Rosa, not Jane, and if Eli actually was Gabe's father, Gabe would have been born 6 weeks early. Of course, Eli couldn't think of a subtle way to ask Gabe if he'd been born prematurely. Ruby was already suspicious of all the invasive personal questions he'd asked. Part of him thought that the worst was true, that he'd been the one to get Gabe's mother pregnant, and that instead of an abortion, she'd had a baby. In this tormented, divided state, one part of his brain insisting that it couldn't be true and another part whispering that it was, Eli existed through endless days and even longer nights. He made conversation and ordered groceries. He washed dishes and folded laundry while he collected the evidence, piece by piece, evidence that, maddeningly, wasn't enough to prove anything. He learned that Gabe's mother had briefly lived in New York, trying to make it as a singer when she'd been young. She didn't have a lot of support, Gabe said. Gabe had been born in California, although whether his mom had gotten pregnant there or in New York, Gabe couldn't say. And Ruby had shrieked at Eli for even asking, "Dad, how is that possibly any of your business?" "Yes, Ruby's on the pill," Sarah had told him when he'd finally brought himself to ask. "No worries there." Frowning, she'd said, "Do you think we should make Gabe sleep in one of the boys' rooms, after all?" Eli shook his head. Too late for that, he thought. He tried to tell himself that young love hardly ever lasted. Once the disease loosened its grip and the world opened and Ruby and Gabe realized that there were other people in it, reality would wake them up with a hard slap to the face, Eli thought, and not a kiss. And they'd figure out that they were too young to promise each other forever. Then the vaccines came. The schools and the offices opened, closed, opened again, as the world stutter-stepped toward its new normal. Instead of breaking up, Ruby and Gabe moved in together, leaving Eli to spend most nights sleepless, staring at the ceiling, one part hoping and praying that his daughter wasn't lying in bed next to her half-brother, another part saying that he just needed to be patient and that eventually they'd break up, and a third part, cool and smirking, telling Eli that he was well and truly fucked, that he'd skated under karma's notice for a good long while, and now he'd finally be getting what was coming to him. Ronnie. "So you're sure?" asked Paul Norman, the real estate agent, as he recapped his pen and put it in his breast pocket. Paul's hair was more silver than light brown these days, and his tanned face had seams around the eyes and mouth. But he was just as handsome as he'd been almost 40 years ago, when he'd sold her and Lee their summer place. "I'm sure," Ronnie replied. "I love it here, but it's just too much house for me." Paul nodded. Ronnie had already given him the tour, the new decks and hot tub, the new outdoor shower, the guest house. He'd made notes and snapped pictures, murmuring to himself as he worked. From her spot on the couch in the living room, Ronnie watched as he walked to the windows and stood there, in his white linen shirt and light blue pants, with his hands in his pockets, looking down at the water. The sun was just starting to set, painting the sky tangerine and saffron, limning Paul in a haze of gold. That had always been her favorite thing, walking up to the third floor just as the sun was setting, raising the blinds to watch its show. From the look on his face, Paul had found it just as enthralling as she had. "This view," he said. "It never gets old." "No," Ronnie said quietly. "It never does." Paul nodded at the couch and the stack of books on the coffee table. "This must be your spot, right?" "I read here," said Ronnie, "in the mornings and then when the sun goes down." That was one of her favorite places, but she also loved the little desk in the pantry, where, beneath a shelf full of cookbooks, she played solitaire on her laptop and paid her bills. She loved her bed, the way she could lie there and hear the ocean through the windows, and the outdoor shower, with the cutouts in its door that let her stand under the spray and catch glimpses of the sea. Her eyes were stinging. She turned away, hoping Paul wouldn't notice, and was relieved when he flipped to a fresh page on his pad and pretended to be busy.
"I don't suppose you remember when you had the roof done?" he asked.
Ronnie did. She gave him the date and told him about the neighborhood association, the home alarm system, and the septic tank, and accepted his condolences on Lee's death.
"I know we sent something."
"Olive oils and vinegars from Atlantic Spice," Ronnie said. "They were lovely. But I wanted to tell you in person. Your husband was one of the good guys." "Yes," Ronnie swallowed hard. "He was." She cleared her throat. "I usually have a glass of wine right about now." This wasn't true. Ronnie had never developed a taste for the stuff. And on the rare occasions that she drank alone, she went straight to the tequila. But she wanted to be a good hostess. "Would you like one?" Paul gave her a smile.
"If you're offering."
She went to the kitchen to find a bottle and collect 2 glasses. While she was pouring, Paul walked along the shelves that lined the living room wall, inspecting the rows of books, eventually finding 2 that she'd written. Ronnie cringed, the way she always did when confronted with the evidence of her previous life. The book's covers looked dated, the fonts out of fashion, the illustrated covers gaudy, the foiled titles garish. Paul picked up one, then the other, and hefted them in his hands.
"Can I ask you a question?"
She nodded, knowing what was coming.
"Why'd you stop writing?" he asked.
Ronnie gave what she hoped looked like an indifferent shrug and kept her tone light.
"Ran out of stories."
That wasn't the truth, and she hadn't ever stopped writing, just publishing, and she'd never told another living soul why. Veronica Levy had grown up in Boston, the daughter of a bank manager and a stay-at-home mom who lived a quiet, middle-class life in a quiet, middle-class suburb. She understood from a very early age that suburban respectability was attainable and desirable. Fame was not. While her high school classmates were sneaking out of their houses to go to rock shows at the Avalon or the Tea Party, when they were wailing into hairbrushes in front of their bathroom mirrors, imagining themselves as famous singers, Ronnie was happy to stay home, sitting in their knotty pine paneled den, watching TV with her parents. While her sister was rolling joints on top of her guitar case and taping an almost life-sized poster of Eric Clapton to the wall of the bedroom they shared, Ronnie was quietly nurturing other dreams, different but just as impractical. Veronica Levy wanted to be a writer. Not a famous writer, insofar as such things existed. The famous female writers Ronnie knew of came in 2 categories. There were the poets, the depressives, and the suicides. Then there were glamorous, best-selling novelists like Rona Jaffe and Jacqueline Suzanne, who went on talk shows to trade barbs with Philip Roth. Veronica could not see herself in either category. Her ambitions were more modest and included staying alive. She would publish short stories and literary quarterlies, and maybe even The New Yorker. She'd also get her PhD, so she'd be able to support herself as a professor. Combined, these 2 pursuits would guarantee her a quiet, contemplative, academic life, a life spent in the company of stories and storytellers, in the land of language and words. It was all she wanted, all she'd wanted since her 5th grade teacher had read her class The Road Not Taken by Robert Frost, and every word, every pause, every image had echoed through her and made her heart feel like a struck gong. Her parents didn't know what to make of her. The Levies had taken pains to give their girls the recommended allowance of art and culture. They had a subscription to the Boston Symphony, and they dutifully brought Suzanne and Veronica to the city's museums. Once a year, there was a trip to New York City for a Broadway show and the Museum of Natural History. But the idea of a child making a living at the arts was utterly foreign, and more than a little frightening. Ronnie had gone to Smith, where her parents had allowed her to major in English. "She can always pick up a teaching certificate," she overheard her mother tell her dad. After she graduated and announced her intention to pursue a PhD in literature, her parents had exchanged a glance. "Ronnie, are you sure that's practical?" her mom had asked gently. "I'll teach," she told them, and watched their faces sag, almost comically, with relief. Those expressions warned her to say nothing more. Better not to tell them about the handful of stories she'd placed in the literary quarterlies and chapbooks and the small magazines, the rejection letters she was already beginning to collect from Harper's and The Atlantic. Better not to tell them how she dreamed of publishing a book of poems or a short story collection or even a novel and making her living as a writer. By the time she was 25 and had completed her master's, Ronnie had been rejected by the editors of every prestigious publication still in existence. A few of them took the time to include encouraging notes along with the "sorry, but this isn't right for us" form letters, and it was enough to keep her going. In her apartment in Cambridge, she piled them all up, all the rejection letters, attached to all the poems and stories she'd written over the years. The ones where she'd tried to sound like John Cheever, and the ones where she'd tried to sound like John Updike, and the ones where she'd tried to sound like Kurt Vonnegut, or Raymond Carver, only Jewish, or Philip Roth, or Saul Bellow, only female. The summer after she completed her dissertation, on the tension between atheism and a yearning for God in the works of the British poet and novelist Stevie Smith, Ronnie put her stories, hundreds, maybe thousands of typed pages, in a plastic milk crate. She put the milk crate in her closet and gently shut the closet door. Then she pulled out the 200-page lined notebook she'd bought at the drugstore, and in neat cursive, she began to write the story of two sisters, a story loosely based on her grandmother, Shirley, and her grandmother's sister, her great-aunt, Anya, and their life as immigrants in America. Her plan was to complete the book, then pay someone to type it. But before that happened, she went on a first date with one of her sister's boyfriend's buddies, a shy, thoughtful law student named Lee Weinberg. They'd gone to the movies, a double feature of Jaws and Rosemary's Baby, then out for dinner at a hole-in-the-wall restaurant that served Szechuan food so hot it made your eyes water. "You order," Lee said. So Ronnie got them dumplings, glistening and fried, crispy, salty egg rolls, and a dish called four-cup chicken, studded with red peppers. Lee's glasses fogged up after his first bite, and his forehead started to sweat, but he kept going gamely. Ronnie was impressed. "Suzanne tells me you're a writer," Lee said. "Aspiring," said Ronnie, and patted her lips. Lee poured more tea from the metal teapot into her cup. Casually, he said, "You know, my aunt's a literary agent." Ronnie's heart began to beat faster. She hadn't known that. Suddenly, Lee Weinberg was looking a lot more appealing, steamy glasses or not. "Really? In New York City?" He named several reputable writers his aunt represented and asked, "What's your book about?" When she told him, two sisters, their marriages, and eventually their daughters and sons, the tension between tradition and modernity, the old world and the new, Lee listened while attempting to maneuver a dumpling onto his plate. After his third try at grasping it with his chopsticks, he'd shrugged, stabbed it through its center with one chopstick's tip, and plunked it in the dipping sauce. "What books would you compare it to?" he smiled, showing even white teeth. "I know that's a question my aunt always asks." Ronnie ran her fingers over the tablecloth, thinking that this was where things got tricky. As much as she'd wanted to be a respected literary writer, she was starting to suspect that she was something else. "It's commercial," she'd said, her voice low as if she was confessing something terrible, like Jacqueline Suzanne or Judith Krantz. Her grad school classmates would have laughed or denied knowing who those writers were, even if they privately devoured those sprawling, dramatic, breathlessly plotted books, hiding the cheap paperback covers beneath more respectable fare. Ronnie had never set out to write that kind of book, even though she'd happily read dozens of them, along with horror and romance and mysteries and every other kind of fiction. She'd simply failed at writing the kind of book she thought she'd wanted to write, the kind the critics would appreciate and future English majors would someday study. Attempting to change the kind of voice in which you wrote or the subjects that interested you, she'd finally decided, was like trying to change your blood type. Instead of trying to turn herself into the kind of writer she would never be, she had decided to write in her own voice and tell the story that kept talking to her, urging her on, the one that made her both a writer and a reader, eager to see what would happen next. Lee Weinberg spooned fried rice onto his plate. "Would you like me to ask my aunt if she'd meet with you?" Ronnie considered. How would she feel if Lee's aunt rejected her? How beholden to him would she be if, somehow, it did work out, and his aunt took her on as a client and actually sold her book to a publisher? How would she feel if she didn't try at all? "Yes," she said. "I'd be very grateful." The next day, Ronnie went into her closet and gathered the short stories that had garnered the most encouraging rejection letters. She sent them to Lee's aunt, along with a note introducing herself and explaining that she'd also written a novel. 2 weeks later, Alice Weinberg called, inviting her to the city. Ronnie tucked the notebook that held the only copy of her now-completed novel into her handbag. She took a train from Boston to New York City and walked uptown to Alice's office in Midtown Manhattan, across from St. Patrick's Cathedral. For the length of the trip, she'd readied herself for the rejection she was certain was coming. She only hoped the woman would be encouraging, maybe offering suggestions for how to improve her work or other places she could submit it. Still, when she'd found herself in the middle-aged woman's office, sitting on the other side of her desk, after she'd glimpsed her short stories sitting in a neat stack, she couldn't keep her heart from swooping madly or from sinking precipitously when Alice Weinberg leaned forward and said, "May I speak frankly?" "Of course." Ronnie had worn her best dress for the meeting, a peasant-style frock in a red and gold paisley print, with an empire waist and dangly ties at the collar. The dress had felt fine back in Boston, only now, compared to Alice's chic black dress, it looked gaudy. Plus, she realized that the sleeves had been made for a woman with a more delicate frame, and the elastic at their ends was biting into her forearms and leaving dents around her wrists. As Ronnie tugged at first one cuff, then the other, Alice rested one hand, manicured fingernails with a diamond solitaire, gold bracelets gently clinking together on an unmarked wrist, atop Ronnie's short stories. "These are fine, and you're definitely a writer. Your prose is very clear. Workmanlike, in a good way," she'd added, even though her lip had curled, unconsciously, Ronnie was sure, as she spoke that word, workmanlike. "But I don't feel like any of these have your heart in them." She'd looked at Ronnie, her expression not especially hopeful. "Lee mentioned a novel? Why don't you tell me about that?" Looking back, Ronnie would never know what gave her the nerve to hand over the notebook. Maybe it was the compliment, the words, "You're definitely a writer," from someone who could say so with authority. The praise, even following so closely on the heels of criticism, left her feeling like she was flying. It's a first draft. It's really rough, she said, almost stammering as Alice leafed through the pages. Tell me about it. Give me the pitch in a sentence or two. Ronnie felt whatever courage she'd briefly conjured slipping away. The notebook looked like something a sixth-grade girl would scribble on in the cafeteria, not something the almost graduate of a prestigious academic program would produce. It wasn't even typed. The longer Ronnie stared at it, the more she began to feel like a fraud. Worse, a fraud who'd handed over some essential part of herself, a piece of her heart, a chunk of her liver, and needed to get it back if she was going to survive. With a great effort, she stilled her fidgeting hands and started to speak. It's about two sisters, how they grow up, their marriages, and the different paths their lives take. It's the story of two Jewish girls becoming American women. There was more to the book than that. Readers would meet their parents in flashbacks as they made their way out of their respective shtetls toward Berlin and one another, in addition to the sisters' daughters, the generation to inhabit the new world. But the part readers would remember, assuming someday there'd be readers, was the two young women, the men they loved, the lives they built. Alice gave her a polite smile, slipping the notebook into a gorgeous leather satchel that Ronnie knew probably cost more than a month's rent back home. Ronnie thanked her for her time and made a hasty retreat. A week later, Ronnie was blow-drying her hair when Alice called. Wrapped in a towel, her hair hanging damp on her shoulders, Ronnie clutched the receiver, hardly believing what she was hearing. No, really, Veronica, I loved it. I couldn't put it down. I have some notes, of course, but that's totally normal. I'd like you to do a polish, and then I'll read it again. But bottom line, I think what you have here is extremely commercial, and... She paused. Ronnie held her breath. I really think I can sell it. Okay, Ronnie had said. She had no idea what exactly she was agreeing to. The only thing she knew for sure was the way her classmates and her professors would sneer at the word commercial. Oh well, she thought. Maybe she'd get an advance, and that would insulate her from their scorn. 2 weeks later, she was once again on a train to New York City, this time in business class instead of coach. Her agent, two words Ronnie had been slipping into every sentence she could, had paid for the ticket. Alice was that confident that she'd be able to sell the book Ronnie had agreed to call The Summer Sisters. Summer being the surname that Rosie, the fictional matriarch, uses to replace Shulevitz when she reaches New York City. Lee had come to the station to see her off. He looked her over in the new clothes she'd bought for the occasion, a gray fedora, a pair of lavender-colored suede boots, impractical and lovely, high-waisted men's-style trousers, a button-down white blouse with a patterned vest on top. This is a new look, he said, in a tone that was mostly approving and slightly puzzled. Ronnie didn't tell him that the clothes were less an outfit and more of a costume, a disguise, which felt appropriate insofar as she felt herself disguised as a novelist, pretending to be a thing that she really was not. She leaned forward to kiss Lee goodbye. She could feel him holding her, wanting to keep her there, lingering on the platform, hoping she'd kiss him again. All the while, the percolating, buzzing excitement inside of her was propelling her forward, urging her to hurry onto the train, to get moving, to get to New York City as quickly as she could before someone else claimed her prize. Alice had reserved her a room at the Algonquin, which delighted Veronica. She imagined Dorothy Parker sitting at the bar each time she walked past it. What followed was a dreamlike, bewildering, joyful 3-day blur of meetings and offices at publishing houses and long, boozy lunches, drinks, and dinners with editors who praised Ronnie's talent and called her a genius and promised her that her novel would be a huge bestseller, that they'd need to build bigger warehouses to store all of the copies of her books. "They're exaggerating," Ronnie said to Alice, as they took a town car back to Ronnie's hotel. "Some," said Alice and smiled, "but not entirely." She squeezed Ronnie's hand. "Enjoy the ride, hun," she said. "This only happens once." By the end of her second day in the city, three publishing houses had made offers. Ronnie called her parents. "You wrote a novel?" Her sister. "Am I in it?" "You can put me in it. Just make me 10 pounds thinner." Her best friends and Lee, laughing and crying, hardly believing her good fortune. With Alice's assistance, she chose the house where she'd be edited by a young woman about her age, where they offered her a contract for 2 books, not just the one she'd written. "You want people who are going to build a career, not just publish a book," Alice counseled. Veronica signed the contract. Then she went back to Boston and stowed the first chunk of money in a savings account at the First Bank of New England, where her father worked. In August, she defended her thesis. In September, she began her first semester as a teacher. The Summer Sisters was scheduled to come out the following spring, right after Mother's Day, which Alice told her was the ideal time for a summer book to go on sale. Ronnie started work on her next book and resumed her academic life, the one she'd thought of as her real life. "Most first novels flop," her agent told her bluntly, "even the ones acquired for a lot of money, even the ones with lots of advertising and publicity money behind them. This could be an exception, but I don't want you counting on it." "In other words, don't quit my day job," Ronnie asked. Alice smiled. "Exactly right." It was easy enough to put her suede boots back in her closet and her fedora on a shelf, easy to stop acting like a novelist, which was what Ronnie felt like she'd been doing. As the school year progressed, she'd get the occasional reminders of what was to come, a cover for her to approve, early starred reviews and the trade publications to squeal over. But for the most part, the idea that she was a soon-to-be-published author felt like a fantasy. Her students, her lesson plans, the books she assigned, the lectures she wrote, and the papers she stayed up late to grade, those things felt real. So did her romance with Lee Weinberg, who was wooing her with great determination. Lee took her for long walks in the public gardens and to a Red Sox game at Fenway Park. They went ice skating on a frozen pond in his hometown in Connecticut, and afterward Lee built a fire in the fireplace, brought her a cup of hot cider, and tucked an afghan made of soft wool around her. "This is wonderful," Ronnie said, as Lee came to sit beside her. Her legs felt pleasantly sore from the skating, unused muscles tingling as they warmed. She settled her head on his shoulder, making a pleased noise as he put his arm around her and pulled her close. "I want to make you happy," he said, murmuring the words against her temple, pressing them into her skin. The Summer Sisters was published in 1979, and it landed with all the splash that Alice and Ronnie's editor, Emily, could have hoped for. A review in Time magazine, and one in Life, and one in Ladies Home Journal. The Boston Globe hailed her as a hometown hero, and a profile that took up most of the Sunday paper's feature section. And the paper's book critic pronounced the novel the must-have beach accessory for this summer. The New York Times critic was more than a little condescending. He called the book glib and melodramatic, words Ronnie knew would live in her memory forever. But it was a long review that featured a full-color picture of the book's cover and a smaller shot of Ronnie, and both Alice and Emily assured her that even a mixed review would interest the readers Ronnie wanted, namely women. If Gary Holt had raved about it, it would have been the kiss of death, Alice explained, over martinis in the Algonquin's bar. Gary Holt is not your audience. Mrs. Gary Holt is. And her sister, her daughters, and every one of her friends, Emily added, and lifted her own martini for a toast. If iPhones and the internet had existed when Ronnie made her debut, the tools that let people track one another's every move, that made everyone immediately reachable, eternally finable, had been around, she wouldn't have been able to compartmentalize her two lives so effectively. In New York City, in her hats and her vests and her tall suede boots, she was an author, and she felt like an author, whether she was posing for publicity shots or giving interviews to reporters or doing readings and signings at the 92nd Street Y. In Boston, in her paisley skirts and peasant blouses, which eventually gave way to kilts and cardigans and penny loafers, she was a professor and eventually a wife. In Boston with Lee, she was Ronnie. In New York with Alice and Emily, both of whom were single, she was Veronica. Maybe that was what had gotten her in trouble, she would think. That sense of being split, of inhabiting two identities, of being two different women in two different worlds, more or less at the same time. On a day in March 1982, 2 months before her second book, After Dawn, was scheduled to come out, Ronnie took the train to New York City. The weather had been miserable the previous week, cold and gray with intermittent sleet, but that morning she'd smelled spring in the air. Just as the train pulled into Penn Station, the sun broke through the clouds. She emerged onto 34th Street and lifted her face to a sky that was brilliantly blue. She walked uptown to her publisher's office and found Emily, her editor, hanging up the phone, bouncing on her toes, practically vibrating with delight. Guess who wants to buy the film rights to Summer Sisters, and just guess how much they want to pay. She broke into a dance, shimmying her shoulders like the news was too big for her to hold still. Guess. Ronnie shook her head, speechless. Emily leaned close and whispered a name and number in her ear. Ronnie drew back, shaking her head in disbelief. No way. Yes, yes. Congratulations, Veronica. The publisher, a silver-haired man who seemed, at 65, impossibly old to Ronnie, had ordered champagne, and that night they'd gone to Elaine's to celebrate. Alice promised she could get them in. Maybe we'll see Woody Allen. In her high-heeled boots and her newest jacket and fedora, with two glasses of champagne already inside her, Ronnie would have said yes to anything. Woody Allen hadn't been there, but Elliot Gould had, and so had Bernadette Peters. Ronnie thought she glimpsed Liza Minnelli in the ladies' room, and she got a look at Elaine herself, holding court from her table in the corner. The first sip of her martini was sliding down Ronnie's throat, like nectar from a glass so icy that her fingers felt chilled when she gripped it, when someone tapped her shoulder. Veronica Levy? She turned. The man was movie star handsome, with a strong jaw and a head full of thick, dark blonde hair. Ronnie felt herself staring. Then Emily was on her feet, grabbing the man's hands and kissing his cheek. And Alice was saying, Veronica, you remember Gregory Bates? Gregory Bates was Emily's colleague, another editor at the publishing house. Veronica had met him in passing when visiting the office and had been struck by his good looks. Come have a drink with us, Emily said. A moment later, Gregory was installed at their tiny high-top table. More champagne and a bucket of ice arrived at the table, and they were toasting Ronnie's film sale, her brilliant future, her brilliant book. By the time the second bottle arrived, the four of them were throwing out casting suggestions for Summer Sisters, with Gregory insisting, absolutely straight-faced, that Jane Fonda should be cast as both Jenny and Jill. She should at least play one of the sisters, but both would be even better. And when Ronnie asked how they'd pull that off, Gregory had said, very solemnly, wigs. And she'd laughed so hard that tears had been streaming down her cheeks. By last call, two bottles of champagne were upside down in their ice buckets, and empty glasses covered their table. Alice had announced with a dignified hiccup that she needed to get home to her cat, and Emily had a breakfast meeting the next morning, and then it was just Veronica and Gregory. "Can I call you a cab?" he asked. Veronica still felt wide awake, tingling with booze and excitement, enthralled with all the good news. She knew she'd never sleep, at least not anytime soon. "I think I'll walk," she said, and Gregory had offered to escort her, even though he lived, she'd learned, on the Upper West Side. "Where are you staying?" he asked, and when she told him she was at the Algonquin, he'd smiled and said, "Of course." Outside, the morning's rain had returned as a luminous mist that filled the air, obscuring the city's grit and dirt. The street lamps glowed like moonstones in the fog, like echoes of the full moon overhead. When Gregory offered her his arm as they crossed Fifth Avenue and entered the park, it seemed rude not to take it. And when they reached the hotel, it seemed rude not to invite him up for a nightcap. Gregory called down to the bar to order a pair of old fashions, and Ronnie went to stand by the window and look down at the city, so different from Boston or from any other place in the world. She imagined she could feel the ground vibrate beneath her. All that coiled energy, all that striving, all the people dreaming dreams of fame and glory. When the drinks arrived, Gregory handed her a glass and stood beside her. "It's something, isn't it?" he asked, his voice low. She turned to him. The dim, pearly light from the street cast his face in shadow. All she could see was his profile, the broad shoulders and firm chest, the angles of his jawline and the straight line of his nose, and what she thought was, "This is my reward." As much as the champagne and the movie deal and the money, she had earned this man, this night, through her determination and her hard work. When she put her hand on his cheek and drew his lips down to hers, Veronica felt like a queen claiming the spoils of a plundered land. They kissed, chests pressed together, one of her hands cupping the back of his head, one of his hands gripping possessively at her bottom. Lee was always so gentle and respectful, touching her with something close to reverence, always watching her face, touching her body, gauging her reactions, and making sure she liked what he was doing. Gregory was as intent on his pleasure as hers, and somehow Veronica found that fiercely arousing. When he bit at her tongue, then her neck, with a sound somewhere between a groan and a growl, she grabbed him as hard as he'd grabbed her, pulling him toward the bed, where Gregory knelt and pulled off her boots. He raised her foot, pressed a kiss to her instep, and began kissing and licking his way up her leg. "Veronica," he whispered, and slid his hand up her thigh. "Now," she said, imperious as an empress as he pulled them off. She propped herself on her elbows, watching as he unbuckled his belt. "I want you inside of me now." She tried not to think about how different he was from Lee. With his curly hair and his sloping shoulders and his gentle eyes, gray-blue behind the glasses that he'd worn since he was 8 years old. She told herself that she wasn't cheating, because she was not the woman Lee knew. There in Boston, she was Ronnie, a sister, a daughter, a PhD candidate, and soon, she suspected, a fiancée, a bride, a wife, and a mother. There, in spite of her achievements, she would be Mrs. Levy, another woman driving carpools in a wood-paneled station wagon, carting cut-up oranges to soccer games, bringing banana bread to the bake sale. She'd seen it happen to her friends, fellow PhD students, some who'd published their work. Put a ring on their finger, and through some dark magic, they turned into wives and mothers, and instead of talking about Elizabethan poetry or symbolism in Shakespeare sonnets or how the market economy had shaped post-Civil War America, It was all teething and toilet training and which towns had the most desirable school districts.
Veronica wasn't ready for that. She wanted to be what she was in the city, a best-selling author, a woman who'd been paid $200,000 to write books and would make even more from the film adaptation, a woman who was ambitious and accomplished and hungry for everything the world could give her. She loved Lee. She wanted a life with him in Boston, children, a house, family vacations, all of it. But before she succumbed, didn't she deserve a little time to be the star of her own life? Didn't every woman deserve that? A few days or months to feel remarkable? She and Gregory met 4 or 5 times over the next year. Veronica was scrupulous about not inventing excuses or lying to Lee. Every time she told him she had to be in New York for work, she was telling the truth. He'd see her off at the train and kiss her goodbye, and then somewhere between Hartford and New Haven, she'd slip her Ronnie skin and turn into Veronica. She and Gregory would meet for drinks, sometimes with Emily or Alice or Gregory's other colleagues, other editors or agents or authors, New York people who made conversation about books and authors, who read novels and poetry and did not just use their New Yorkers as ornaments for their coffee table, set dressing that would signal certain values to any visitors. She and Gregory were careful not to look at each other too much or to touch, although sometimes Gregory would let his fingertips linger on her shoulders as he pulled out her chair, or trail against the back of her neck as he helped her on with her coat. Sometimes they'd go to dinner, at restaurants Gregory chose, Greek or French or Italian, and once sushi, which Veronica had never eaten before. Gregory fed her bits of slippery fish from his chopsticks. They would eat and talk about books that they'd read, other authors Gregory was working with, or books that he'd acquired. At some point, under the table, his foot would brush her ankle. His fingers would touch her hand as he poured her more wine. Sometimes she'd want him so desperately that they'd end up in the ladies' room, kissing frantically, groping each other with other patrons banging on the door. Once they hadn't been able to make it back to the hotel. Gregory had backed her into an alley, pushing her against the rough brick wall, shoving her skirt up around her waist as she wrapped her legs around him and closed her eyes. Veronica knew that Gregory dated other women. Gregory knew that Veronica had a boyfriend in Boston. It didn't stop them or even slow them down. As things with Lee became more serious, he started to plan for holidays and weddings months in advance, with the unspoken assumption that they'd be attending as a couple, and ask her about the various suburbs they might theoretically live in someday. Ronnie knew that she should end the affair. She wanted to be with Lee, wanted the life she would have with him. Maybe things weren't as glamorous in Massachusetts or as exciting. Maybe she herself was different there, less extroverted, happy to let someone else be the center of attention. But she was comfortable with Lee, who was steadfast and loyal. He would always love and care for her. She couldn't say the same for Gregory. But still, she couldn't bring herself to give him up. Whenever she was in New York, she could feel her Boston life, her real life, the life she wanted, at least with most of her heart, most of the time, beckoning, waiting to consume her. She knew that, at the very least, she should feel guilty about what she was doing. Lee, she knew, was scrupulously faithful to her, even surrounded by young, comely paralegals and secretaries. He'd been shy in high school, a boy who preferred reading Isaac Asimov novels to most sports, and he'd been, he told her with a wry expression, shorter than his 5'3" mother until his junior year. Now he was taller, solidly built, and pleasant-looking, with a law degree and a successful practice, and still charmingly oblivious to the women who flirted with him, the way his secretary would smooth his tie
or a waitress would brush her arm against his as she set the check down on the table. He'd be, she knew, a good husband and father. And yet for almost an entire year, the affair continued. She kept seeing Gregory even after she and Lee moved in together to an apartment on Beacon Street, right near the Charles River, and began planning a wedding for the following year. She didn't stop, and she didn't feel guilty. Maybe she would have if she'd taken up with some man in Boston, a fellow academic, or a friend's husband, or a stranger she'd met on the tee. But of course Ronnie would never do such a thing. She would never dare. Veronica was a different creature. Veronica dared. In the end, it was Gregory who'd ended it. They'd been at the Algonquin, where it had started. In bed, Gregory had leaned down, gently brushing a lock of Veronica's hair behind her ear. "This has been wonderful, but we need to say goodbye." She felt the shock of it rocketing through her and opened her mouth to ask him why when he said gently, "I'm getting married in the spring." Veronica swallowed hard. It made her a hypocrite. Why was it okay for her to have someone else, but wrong if Gregory did? Why was it wrong for him to be getting married when she was too? Her face felt frozen as she made herself ask, "Who is she?" "No one you know." He caressed her thigh idly, one fingertip tracing the line where her leg met her groin. "She's a girl I've known forever. Her parents know my parents. We all summer together in the Hamptons." "Ah," thought Veronica, feeling bitterness twisting in her heart. Of course, he'd marry someone else who used summer as a verb. Probably this girl Gregory had known forever was pretty and petite and blonde. All at once, Veronica felt plain and unlovely, her nose too big and her skin too dark. "You're right," she said, and moved away from him. "It's time to stop." Gregory reached for her, his hands unusually gentle, his voice tender. He held her face in his hands, the skin of his palms warm on her cheeks. "I'll never forget you." They'd made love one last time, slowly. Gregory had kissed her body, touching her like he was trying to memorize her shape and the smell and feel of her skin. He'd been inside of her, rocking slowly, holding her thighs, pulling her body as closely against him as he could, when Veronica had gasped and frozen, "Condom!" "Oh, shit," Gregory had pulled out of her, gotten on a condom, and they'd finished. Afterward, he'd fallen asleep while Veronica had lain awake beside him, counting backward to the date of her last period, trying to convince herself that she'd be okay. They'd always used condoms, even the time in the alley. They'd always been careful. Surely she wouldn't find herself in trouble because of this one brief lapse, she thought. Surely not. 3 weeks later, she missed her period. "It's fine," Lee said, holding her as she cried, and of course not understanding why she was crying. "Look, you'll go to the doctor. Maybe it's a false alarm, and if it's not..." He held her face in his hands, which only made her think of Gregory. She'd swallowed hard as Lee said, "We were going to get married anyhow. This just accelerates the timetable a bit." Sick with shame, hating herself for deceiving this good, kind man, Ronnie had nodded. He'd been the one to call her doctor, and after, he'd brought her a warm washcloth and tenderly wiped the tears off her face. "I don't deserve you," she'd sniffled. "Of course you do," said Lee. "It will be his baby," Ronnie told herself a month later, when the doctor confirmed what 2 weeks of nonstop nausea had already suggested. "Whatever the truth of it is, this baby is going to be Lee Weinberg's son or daughter." Gregory had dark blonde hair, thick and straight. Lee's hair was brown and wavy. Gregory's skin was pale. Lee's was darker, and it tanned easily in the summertime. Gregory was almost 6 feet tall, broad-shouldered and narrow-waisted and graceful. Lee was a few inches shorter, with a tendency to stoop. Their faces and features were completely different. Different noses, different cheeks, different foreheads, different chins. None of it mattered, Ronnie told herself fiercely. There was only the tiniest chance that Gregory was the father, and even if it was true, this would be Lee's baby. Lee would believe it. He had, Ronnie thought sadly, no reason to doubt her. Then, at her 6-month appointment, the doctor heard 2 heartbeats. "Twins," he said, slapping Lee on the back. Lee's face lit up with delight as Ronnie lay on her back, her legs still in the stirrups, frozen in shock, paralyzed with shame. "We always said we wanted 2," Lee told her, down in the parking garage as he hurried around the car. They'd already bought what Ronnie had dubbed the inevitable Volvo, to hold the door open for her. "Yes," Ronnie said. She felt numb. She felt like her guilt was right there on her face, like Lee could see, and Dr. Sanderson could see, and astronauts in outer space could see what she had done. The next morning, after Lee had gone to work, she called a gynecologist, not the one she used, a stranger whose name she'd pulled from the phone book at random. "Twins with different fathers?" the woman repeated. After Ronnie had introduced herself and said that she was researching a new novel. "It's rare, but it does happen. Some months a woman releases 2 eggs instead of 1. If both of them end up being fertilized within a day or 2, and then both successfully implant, you've got 2 babies with different dads. Of course, it's much more likely that one man fathered both babies." Ronnie hoped the woman couldn't hear the tremble of her voice. "So let's say the twins have different fathers. Would her husband be able to tell right away, as soon as the babies were born?" "Well, for example, if the fathers are different races, that would make it pretty obvious," the doctor said dryly. "But beyond that, unless you did genetic testing, you wouldn't be able to tell. If the babies don't look too different, and if the husband has no reason to suspect that he's not the father, your main character wouldn't have much trouble pulling the wool over his eyes." Ronnie felt sick. When the doctor paused, Ronnie was certain she was going to say, "This isn't a theoretical question, is it? Why don't you tell me what's really going on?" But instead, the doctor said, a little shyly, "Love your books, by the way." Ronnie thanked her and promised to send her a signed copy of After Dawn. She hung up the phone and sat at the kitchen table, with one hand resting on the ledge of her belly. Maybe both babies were Lee's. Maybe both of them were Gregory's. Maybe each man had fathered a baby. Should she try to find out the truth? And what would she do with that information, assuming that she could obtain it? "Break my husband's heart," she thought. Ronnie decided to wait and see, assuming the babies did not look obviously, visibly like they had different gene pools. She would keep quiet. The truth would only hurt Lee. She tried to tell herself that she wasn't lying, that the woman Lee had married had never cheated on him. That woman, the one who'd let Gregory shove her skirt up around her waist and fuck her against the rough brick of an alleyway, was someone else, someone Ronnie felt like she'd barely known, and she thought someone she wouldn't have liked much if she had. And if the babies clearly did have different fathers, she decided to cross or burn that bridge when she came to it. Then Sam and Sarah were born. They didn't look like Lee. They didn't look like Gregory. They looked like babies, pink-faced and toothless, both with tiny button noses and faint sketched-in eyebrows. Both of them had the same fine brown hair. Both had eyes the same dark blue shade, although Sarah's eyes had lightened to a changeable blue-gray, while Sam ended up with hazel eyes. As they grew up, Sarah, confident and assertive, with blonde hair that shaded to light brown as she got older, and Sam, quiet and shy, dreamy with Lee's curls, happy to let his sister push through the world on both of their behalf. Ronnie had some strong suspicions about their paternity. but she never did any testing, not even when the technology for doing so became more accessible. After that last night in New York, she never got in touch with Gregory or Googled his name after Google became a thing. She never told Lee of her suspicions as the years went by and the kids grew up. It was her secret to keep, her burden to bear. Lee had been their father in every way that mattered, and if biology told a different story, he never needed to hear it. The few times Ronnie had to go back to New York, she went wearing the armor of motherhood, depending on it, plus its attendant exhaustion, to keep her chaste and untouched. Emily was also married by then. Their long, boozy lunches and the late nights out came to a natural end, replaced by breakfast meetings and coffees. She'd never set foot